Fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with the ramifications of this parable of the recalcitrant tenants or the absentee landlord, whichever way you want to view it. Both are true. And as we closed here in point 44, we've made it plain that Israel was not permanently removed as God's priest nation, but is temporarily replaced by the church. Thus, the age of Israel is interrupted by the church age, but will resume with the final 7 years of Daniel's 70th week. We were looking at the Romans 11 passage, or getting ready to. And essentially, he uses this analogy of an olive tree in which the principle of grafting is not unknown, certainly in Israel and in any agricultural communities. They understood this, but if some of the branches were broken off, i.e. Jewish branches, and you were grafted in among them, i.e. you Gentiles, and you became partaker with the rich root of the olive tree, that historical, we understand, biblical, historical Christianity finds its roots in the Old Testament covenants with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we find that essentially Christianity, of course, goes... Biblical Christianity goes back to Genesis, back to the very beginning. But we recognize that under progressive revelation that this was not all revealed all at once, certainly. And that we benefit from the spiritual heritage of Israel, even though we're not Israelites. Even though we're not Jewish. So you were grafted in. Well, God can do this. He says, don't be arrogant towards the branches. Again, we understand that when we're dealing with Jews... there are Jews and there are Jews. But anti-Semitism is something you better be very careful about. I recognize that there are very evil Jews out there, just like there are very evil Gentiles. And that Jews, certain Jews have manipulated history and done other things, but so have Gentiles. It's not like this was limited to the Jews. When I look at the people who are anti-Semitic, what do I find? I find Muslims. I find white supremacists. I find Nazis. Do I want to really identify myself with these groups? No, not really. Whatever I am, I'm not a skinhead. I may be getting there, but I'm not one at this point. But I'm not getting there mentally. I meant physically, obviously. So that was a loss of hair joke for those of you listening far and wide by radio or whatever else. Well, so he says, look, don't be arrogant toward the branches. Remember that it's not you who supports the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. Quite right, but they were broken off for unbelief. But you stand by your faith. Do not be conceited, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, and here's essentially a prophecy about the removal of the church, because they're going to fall, the church is going to go the same way that Israel did in terms of negative volition and blowing off God's plan. Only the church is far more culpable because we have far more revelation. So we have the completed canon of Scripture. Where Israel, I mean, it's not as though they were lacking in substantial revelation. They had it. But we certainly know as church age believers, we have the New Testament revelation to go with the Old Testament revelation. And if he didn't spare the natural branches, he won't spare you either. So, verse 23, but they also, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in. A prophecy that, in fact, there is a restoration coming for Israel. I mean, he's talking about it in terms of hypotheticals, but I believe Paul knows it's real. I believe I understand it's real. It's coming. We're not there yet. God is able to graft them in again. And then he talks about this partial hardening that's happened to Israel. Well, 45, it should be clear that Israel is the only nation, bold, double score, underline, circle it, neon letters, the only nation with which God has established a covenant. And there is no other nation in history that serves as Israel does in God's plan. And 46, although the church is called a nation, it is evident that it is not actually a nation, but is comprised of believers from all nations. And during the church age, this includes believing Jews as well. Now, they become a part of the church if they are in the church age and believe during that dispensation. It doesn't mean they're not Jewish. And how this all will play out in the future, well, certainly if they're in the church age, they're going to be raptured. Whereas their Israelite counterparts who believed in other dispensations, particularly the age of Israel or pre-age of Israel, or even Daniel's 70th week, they're not going to get their resurrection until after Daniel's 70th week at the beginning of the millennium. So how the Jew will be treated in all of this kind of depends upon where he comes into the dispensation and where he orients. It's not just a matter that he's in the dispensation. Because you got Jews living in the church age now. They live in this dispensation, but they're unbelievers. Well, they're not a part of the church. They are still technically a part of Israel, at least racially and maybe culturally, but they're not a part of Israel, i.e. unbelieving Israel. And so, again, 47, although some here have advocated such doctrines as the pivot, invisible heroes, and client nations. I love all these verses of these terms that substantially lack documentation. You can't find these terms in the Bible anywhere, not even anything that resembles these terms. And to deal with the setting aside of Israel, and that's where these terms come out of. It comes out of the historical setting aside of Israel and then the church replacing Israel. These teachings have been propounded with very little or no biblical documentation and with statements such as these. Client nation is a national entity in which a certain number of spiritually mature Christians, called the salt of the earth. Okay. When Jesus told the disciples they were the salt of the earth, do you believe they were mature? Is this our doctrine? Is this how stupid we are when it comes to exegesis? That we look at the disciples in Matthew 5 and say, well, they were mature believers. No, they weren't. They weren't even close. They were barely at that level even believers in some senses. I mean, when they'd made the adjustments, they had not progressed far beyond that. I mean, that they had not gone far. So number one, first my question is, in the Bible does it teach that a client nation is a national entity with a number of spiritually mature believers? Any verse, just a verse. Just one verse out of the 66 books, out of the 1,197 chapters, out of the thousands and thousands of verses, find me one verse that you can hang this statement on. And this is the problem with faulty exegesis. And in some cases in the doctrinal movement, people have swallowed this stuff hook, line, and sinker because it was just dogmatically asserted long enough. And if you make a dogmatic point long enough, it becomes truth. Well, I'm dogmatically making the point that I'm a millionaire. I'm a millionaire. I'm a millionaire. I'm a millionaire. And guess what? I'm still not a millionaire. I can make the point as long and as loud as I want. If there's no documentation or truth to it, what have I got? Nothing but a long, loud point. So they have formed a pivot sufficient to sustain the nation and through which God specifically protects this nation so that believers can fulfill the divine mandates of evangelism, communication, and custodianship of Bible doctrine, providing a haven for Jews and sending missionaries abroad. Wait a minute, isn't this just the definition of nationalism, period? Isn't this what nations that do in general? Not just, quote, a client nation, any nation can do this. And the reason all nations were formed so people could orient to God? Acts 17 makes it pretty plain to me that the establishment of nationalism was the reason that God used for protecting positive volition and providing an environment in which positive volition could find God, in a sense. Acts 17:26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, although he's not far from every one of us. Well, clearly here established is the principle of nationalism as a purpose for sustaining and providing an environment in which positive volition can find God. That's what it's for. Custodianship of Bible doctrine has been handed to a nation. What? I thought that was the church's job. That's not a nation's job. That's the church's job. Now, the church, obviously, is called a nation. I get that. But that's not a physical nation's job. Can you imagine if people started teaching and saying, well, China is the new client nation? Why? Well, because they're the richest, most powerful nation now just about on the planet. And spending more. Well, be a client nation is simply a national entity in which the civil government recognizes establishment principles of freedom, including privacy and the sacredness of property and life. Then I would suggest that by this definition, the U.S. government has abandoned these ideas long ago and has substituted socialism, illegal taxation, and oppressive government that is actively working to remove individual rights and freedom. Thus, according to this definition, the U.S. cannot be a client nation. If this definition is correct, by the way, I don't buy this definition either. But if it is correct, and it's not, then according to this definition, our nation has failed miserably. And who do you want, the socialist or the Mormon? Take your pick. Pick your poison and see what we get. Well, see, a client nation is a national entity under the patronage of God, assigned the responsibility for the formation, preservation, communication, and fulfillment of the canon of Scripture. Foolish me, I thought the church was responsible for those things. When did these become national things? They never were in the Bible. The only nation you can point to where God told them, you've got to do this, is Israel. Israel only. I see no other nation where God. So the canon was neither formed, protected, or communicated by nations. It was done by believers and churches. And when you get into the development of both the Old Testament canon and the New Testament canon, and you study issues related to bibliology and these other factors, it wasn't nations that did this. Were some nations more pro-Christian than other nations? Somewhat, sure. But does that make them special and give them some special place with God? No. No, and just because they're more pro-Christian doesn't mean anything about their nation. Because as far as I understood it from Acts 17 here, that God has already determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. And so he knows about all nations, where they're going to be, when they're going to be. And the reality is that the formation of the canon, the church, and all of this, the formation of the canon and the scriptures, this wasn't done by nations. This was done by individual believers and churches. That's where this was done. History proves this. I mean, just go back and read church history. Read the, understand bibliology, and this wasn't done by nations. Well, the client nation to God contains a pivot of mature believers who, as invisible heroes, we can't see us. I like that. Provide the prosperity of that nation through the principle of blessing by association. That blessing is generally not visible to the general public. Okay, so now I've got invisible people and invisible blessings. What? What? Invisible people and invisible blessings. Well, how am I to discern these? Well, they're invisible. You can't. This is charged language designed to psych believers up into some deal that largely is nationalistic in its approach and not biblical in its approach, and get them psyched up so these invisible heroes, not God, provide prosperity to the nation. Wait a minute, I thought God provided prosperity to the nation. Now, can God use people? Obviously, yes, he does. But I think Solomon, if you look at Solomon in his heyday, I think you would have to say Israel was the most prosperous nation on the planet at that time. And as far as I understand Solomon, for many years during his reign, he was completely corrupt. I mean, he was a whore dog. He just chased women, and that was what he did. That's where he devoted his life. I mean, he built the temple and all of that. But after a certain point, he began to get into idol worship. He began to get into pursuing these women and all of these things. So did Solomon provide the blessing for the nation during that time, or did God? I would conclude it wasn't Solomon. I mean, seriously? Now he's going to use negative believers in reversionism, and this is the source of blessing? Well, these invisible heroes aren't negative believers in reversionism, right? Well, who are they? Well, again, the use of certain language is designed to evoke a certain emotional response from the hearer. Don't you like being an invisible hero? Don't you like being a hero, period? Isn't it nice to know that you're a hero? Well, this makes me think pretty well of myself, I have to admit, if this is all true. No, God provides prosperity for the nation, and the prosperity, and I'm sorry, I can see my prosperity, it's in the bank. I can give you a figure. I can see where God blesses me in all of this. And you know what? It doesn't often come really from even other believers. It's not to say that God doesn't use other believers. But largely, God blesses principles like, diligence, hard work, these types of things. I think God's pretty well made plain in His Word, He blesses. Well, E, as an invisible hero, the believer becomes part of the pivot, which is the last stand of any client nation and its only basis for genuine blessing. So now we got to have invisible heroes, we got to have the pivot, we got to have client nations. Again, where does any of these principles come from? Where does any of this language come from? This is the, frankly, this is the fanciful exegesis of people who will not adhere to the principles of sound exegesis and hermeneutics that we're supposed to be inculcating and teaching and advancing in doctrinal churches. And they want to have all this. Well, again, this is very charged language, frankly. It evokes a particular emotional idea and response from the hearer. Well, the pivot of mature believers establishes the client nation and guarantees its perpetuation in every generation. Well, wait a minute. I thought the above definition said a client nation was based on the type of government. Now, who provides the basis for this, the government or the pivot? Which is it? See, there's so much double talk in this as well. So much contradiction in these things that you look at them and you think, whatever the motivation was. And here's one of the things, we just covered this yesterday in hermeneutics. The principle that the end justifies the mean hermeneutically and exegetically. So in order to provide a blessing for people, I'm going to come up with this creative exegesis and creative vocabulary that is designed to be a blessing. But because I'm trying to be a blessing, it's all okay. No, it's not. It's not okay, all okay. You can't just start throwing around terms and act like they're biblical just because you've said them. I mean, we've seen people, you've seen people, you've run across them, that if they think it's right simply because they think it. It must be right, I think it, it's right. Well, the same thing's true here. You can't just create vocabulary that doesn't have any real biblical basis, in fact, and ultimately start teaching this to believers. Well, what does this do? This disorients believers. It gets them believing things that really aren't correct, in fact, that are very, at least problematic from an exegetical standpoint and a documentation standpoint. Well, gee, during the time of the four... And by the way, I take this directly from their teachings. This is not ad-libbed. You can go right down here and you can go to the web page and you can see that this is taken word for word from their teachings. I am not misrepresenting them in any way. During the time of the formation of the New Testament, the client nation changed from Judea to the Roman Empire. What? What? The Roman Empire historically persecuted Christians and killed them. From about 64 under Nero, up through guys like Diocletian and these other people, really up until the time of Constantine in about 325 AD. These people were persecuted. Rome is the client nation. Wow. So Rome replaced Israel, not the church. Where in the world do you get that theology? That is flat out false doctrine. There is no documentation for that. And this is just the kind of junk that's passed off as sound teaching out there. And this is junk. I mean, this stuff is junk. So Jesus is referencing the Roman Empire in his teaching. Well, I didn't get that. Well, you know, I didn't understand it was going to be the Romans that took over. Well, following Rome, according to this imaginative doctrine, the Goths were his next client nation during the 4th century. Scotland and Ireland during the 5th and 6th, the Franks during the 8th and 9th, the Vikings during the 10th, Germany and Switzerland during the 16th, Sweden and the Huguenots during the 17th, Brandenburg, Prussia during the 18th, England during the reign of Victoria only, in the 19th century, and finally the United States has been a client nation from 1776 until the present. I guess I have to take your word for it, since there's not one shred of biblical or historical proof for these declarations. All they're doing is saying people that were generally amenable and didn't persecute the truth became client nations. What? So I thought they had to have a series of mature believers and blah, blah, blah. No, these were just nations that were generally neutral. I mean, I know that when I really want to get into a fight, I want the Swiss with me. Because we know they'll take a stand. Well, and much of this is simply based on the idea that these groups were successful and prosperous, thus God must be for them. So anything that's successful or prosperous, God's blessing. Well, the Federal Reserve is doing great. Thank you very much. The banks are doing fine. We bail them out, you know. We bail out the car industry. We bail out the bank. And I'm waiting for the pharmaceutical companies to come around and get their hand out. But no, they're doing fine because they just keep inventing diseases and cures for them. Pills to cure it. So we have all these new diseases. Well, guess what? To say something is successful, therefore God's for it. I mean, Hitler was successful for quite a while. I mean, if you watched Hitler there for 5, 6, 7 years, you would have thought it was going pretty good, I think. Hey, look, God's really blessing us. Yeah? Huh. No, I don't think so. And this kind of teaching is just so full of holes and so biblically irresponsible. And this is what's passed off as sound doctrine. That's what's scary. This is what's passed off as sound teaching. Well, a client nation is responsible for 5 things. Oh, well, at least we have some responsibilities. It must preach the gospel to its own population at home. It must communicate Bible doctrine to the believers in the nation. It must take care of and guard the word of God and set it and see that it gets out free of charge. It must provide a safe place for the Jews, and it is responsible to send out missionaries to preach the gospel to other nations. Again, isn't this the responsibility of the church, not a nation? Well, if the church is viewed as a nation, then all this makes sense. But perhaps I was absent when Jesus taught this all about client nations. I must have missed that somewhere in seminary, and in all my studies, I've missed all this somehow. Well, the reason I've missed all this is it's nonsense. There's not a shred of documentation for this stuff. Now, are there mature believers within a nation? Sure. Is the nation responsible for all of these things? No, there's not at all. And even in Israel, was it the nation, was it the national leaders that were charged with this stuff, or was it the priest's responsibility to teach the doctrine to the people? As far as I understood, it was the priests. They were to be the teachers of the truth. Didn't say Israel at large. You had to be a son of Aaron to be a priest, or a descendant of Aaron. So again, I look at this stuff, I take their exact words, and number one, it's double talk. Number two, there's no scriptural documentation. Number three, it's full of contradictions. Number four, some of it's just flat out wrong. And yet this is pounded into people as though this is true doctrinal history. So the Romans replaced Israel. Huh, that's a unique view. I never heard that one before. I don't know how anybody could be so stupid as to advocate that position, frankly. That is doctrinally stupid. There is nothing in the Bible, not one shred of evidence that Rome took over. And historically, again, they persecuted the church. Now they're the client nation. Well, wait a minute, isn't the client nation responsible not to persecute the church? Oh, and make sure doctrine gets out? Yeah, that's what Rome was doing. No, they weren't. Not at all. Well, 48, the use of intentionally charged language, like invisible heroes, may sound good to some believers. But again, on what passage or passages do the doctrines of the invisible hero, the pivot, and the client nations rest? In 49, in fact, if one reads the doctrines of the pivot or the client nation, he should be appalled at the absolute lack of documentation. The fanciful and speculative exegesis that's represented, and the dogmatic assertions that lack actual proof. Well, we're fighting against that. See, as a part of standing for the truth, we have to say, you know, these people that have deviated from this. And a lot of this is designed to communicate and arouse the rah-rah patriotism deal in people that is indicative of people like Gary Horton and these types of people who have manifested and taught doctrinally that essentially the military is the answer to all our problems. Everybody should be in the military, and the military is great. And guess what? It's not. It's not. It may have been at one time, but it's not now. It's clearly not now. Anybody that goes and reviews, you don't want to know the history of this nation. Frankly, most believers don't want to know what our government has done. You don't really want to get the facts behind Pearl Harbor, trust me. You don't want to get the facts behind Vietnam. You don't want to know the truth about this stuff. You don't want to know the truth about Iraq and Afghanistan. And we get little pictures of it from time to time. We get the, you know, the average American doesn't want to stop and think about the fact that we're holding people without due process. And the government has no limitations upon its power, apparently, any longer. And it can pretty much do what it wants. Well, that may all sound good for the rah-rah patriotism approach, but you know what? I don't find the rah-rah patriotism approach taught in the Bible. I don't even see Paul, who's a member of Israel, doing the rah-rah Israel thing. In fact, if you read Paul's writings carefully, he's very even-handed about it. He recognized the Jews are largely in unbelief. They're going to go into dispersion. This is going to happen. These prophecies are against them. They're eventually going to embrace the Antichrist. Well, that doesn't make me feel that good about my nation. Oh, you're going to embrace the Antichrist? Well, that's not too good. Well, you know, again, all of this is designed to, well, let's all get together today and sing God Bless America. And that'll make it so. I'll be like that guy and start to make it so. And, you know, it doesn't make it so, sadly. Well, 50, this is a single example of, quote, doctrinal teaching that people have accepted based on nothing more than the dogmatic assertions of a single individual, which assertions are not even consistent throughout the teaching. And 51, this is an example of unrestrained teachings that do not come from sound and consistent exegesis, are not governed by sound hermeneutic principles, but are often nothing more than the dogmatic statements of a demagogue, an orator or a political leader who gains power and authority by arousing the emotions, passions, and prejudices of the people. Well, is that really what a pastor is supposed to be? And my answer to that is no, that is not what the pastor is supposed to be. If you want to have a rah-rah patriotism rally, good for you, go have it. But I understand the doctrines and I understand the prophecies and I know that this nation is not going to recover. And any statements about how great it is or how many mature believers we have or anything else is not going to deliver America. It's not going to be delivered. We would have healed Babylon, but she would not be healed. We would have given her the doctrine, but people don't want to hear the truth about all this. They want to hear rah-rah. We're great. You know, the Olympics. I remember when I was a kid. I mean, this stuff had way more sway over me when I was a child. You know, when I was 8 or 9 or 10. You know, when the Olympics would come on each year, you'd cheer against the Russians because you were a rah-rah American. And do you believe in miracles? Yeah. And everybody thinks still to this very day that the U.S. won the gold medal that day. They didn't. We beat the Russians. But it was all, you know, U.S. against everybody. It was all international, national against national. It was patriotism and all of that. And your guys could do no wrong. I cheered for Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay at the time. And then I heard him talk. And I thought, he doesn't represent my nation. He's an idiot. And he started espousing his mother. I got a new name. I got my new name. Oh, good for you. Well, guess what? Rah, 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 Muhammad Ali's my hero. Ooh, no, he's not. And that's where some of that stuff can lead. And children are very susceptible to this. And so we want to teach our children the correct biblical viewpoint on this. Yes, do I support my nation? Sure, I pay taxes. I'm an obedient citizen. I do all the things that are expected of me. And all these things, I allow the government to systematically take my rights away from me one by one without violence, without resisting. But this is what doctrine teaches us to do. James 5 deals with that. The righteous man does not resist you, even when you're doing this stuff. Well, we're not here to foment anarchy or any of that other stuff. But we're also not here to make patriotism equal to sound doctrine. And patriotism and sound doctrine are not the same things. They never have been. They never will be. And so people have all these ideas, but again, you go and you look at some of these teachings that have passed as sound, and they're just horrific in my estimation. They certainly do not reflect thoughtful and diligent exegesis. Nope, they come and they get the vocabulary and they establish all of this. And I'm not against vocabulary that's outside the Bible. The word rapture is not used in the Bible. The word Trinity is not used in the Bible. The word evangelism is, but it's used so sparingly that you would almost think evangelism wasn't that important. Well, if you understand the essence of God, and you understand the doctrine of calling and election, and you recognize that God's responsible to make sure that positive volition gets the truth, then that relieves a lot of the burden of how important evangelism is for me. Now, I'm responsible on a daily basis to be light, to set an example, to share the gospel with anybody that's interested. But I'm not responsible to go out and knock on their door and headbutt them and say, I'm here to save you. That's not what we're doing. The word missionary is not used in the scripture. And largely by the end of the first century, the concept of the missionary was no longer even considered that much, that important. Why? Because as Paul said in Romans, the word's gone out pretty much to the ends of the earth. By the time of the end of Paul's life, he had taken the gospel as far west as you could take it. And others had taken it north, and others had taken it east, and others had taken it south. And so to suggest that the poor world just doesn't know and that God's kind of hid all this from them, it's just not true. The gospel has permeated every section of the world. I mean, there may be isolated pockets where there's some indigenous people living back in the middle of nowhere, existing under Stone Age primitive conditions. But that's, number one, that's a rarity, if you even find all that. And so the gospel has permeated this world. Well, 52, therefore, from a biblical standpoint, there is no nation other than Israel with whom God has entered into a personal relationship. And asserting such nonsense is counterproductive, confuses believers, and is biblically wrong. 53, the church is the organization that replaced Israel and will continue to be the only biblically authorized agent for advancing the plan of God until it ultimately fails during the Laodicean period and will be removed at the rapture. We've looked at that about the verses, about the branches being snapped off. And in Revelation 3:14 and following, we look at the church as it exists at the time of the end. The predominant form that the church has now assumed is the lukewarm type church. They're not against God, but they're not necessarily for Him. They like some of the principles of the Bible, but they don't like the others. They think women ought to be in the ministry, homos ought to be ordained, and all other manner of weirdness that they think. And they basically have largely quit teaching the Word of God. They've gone to sermonizing, if that. And in many cases, it's now been replaced by liturgy. And I've never actually gone to a Catholic service, but for the people that tell me that they have, it's apparently just like you don't have any clue what's going on. Well, I mean, it's always important to have your doctrine taught in Latin, because it's not a dead language. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, it is. It's not. It's a dead language. Why use it? Insanity. Absolute insanity. So Revelation 3:14 and following just deals with that period of history. And essentially the fact that the church now makes Jesus sick. Nauseates him. The church at large. I'm not talking about individual churches doing it right. Because the Philadelphia-type churches must exist out there, because where in the world else are the Laodiceans going to get the pure gold? How are they going to get it? If not for somebody out there doing it right. There has to be people doing it right at the end. And that largely has been ignored, because the Laodicean period has said, oh, well, it's all horrible, horrible, horrible. But yet there have to be these Philadelphia-type churches that are holding to the principles of the faith. That's what we're shooting for. I make no secret about it. That's exactly what we better shoot for. Other than that, we'll be, you know, one of these other lesser churches. I don't want that. So 54 with verse 9. Verse 9 ends with the parable. With verse 9, Jesus ends the parable, which indicates that the murder of the son was the most outrageous act of defiance in which the tenants could have engaged. In 55, it is clear that Jesus has revealed to the religious leaders. Now, I think this is subtle, but I think they got it. That he's aware of their nefarious plans against him. He knows about the murder plots. Now, they think they've covered all this. They've got their bases covered and that nobody knows and they're so slick and all this. But Jesus knows. He knows. And however, this is his final appeal to them. to recognize the serious and ultimately catastrophic nature of their chosen course of action. You are plunging this nation into ruin. And really, realistically, if the Jews were patriots, these people should have been taken out. But we don't, again, as biblical believers, we don't have that option. If we find out that our government is traitorous, and there's a book, and it's an older one, I think the first one was called Some Call It Conspiracy. And there's another follow-up to it, a sequel, called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. And it basically goes in, and there's documentation. I've got a lot of biblical isagogics and stuff on the U.S. and what we've done in history and the types of deals we've made and who's been calling the shots. And the getting sold out as early as Woodrow Wilson, we were getting sold out. And probably even before. But we may not even know about it all. So the nation was being cheated then, and they set us up for failure. They engineered the Great Depression. Good grief. This was manipulated by people behind the scenes, powerful people. This didn't just happen. It's not like they can just crash the stock market, can they? Oh, yeah, we've seen it several times in history. Black Friday, Black Monday. Hopefully we'll get a Black Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to go with them. We'll have us a full match set of black days, all related to the stock market. Well, of course they can. Well, these people are not patriots. These people do not care about their nation. And they're in the position of rulership. That's troublesome. That's dangerous. That ultimately, that's not what they're there for. Well, 56, while they clearly do not recognize it, their rejection of the authority of John the Baptist, coupled with their rejection of the Son, which has been the emphasis since Mark 11:28, will result in a final catastrophic judgment on them and the nation they lead. And 57, as they and so many people do not seem to understand, when one rejects the teaching and direction of the communicator that God has placed and established, he's rejecting the God who sent him in the first place. And for these people, their rejection of Jesus is tantamount to their rejection of God. That's the only way it can go. As he says, he who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. And he who rejects me or listens to me listens to the one who sent me. Luke 10:16. The one who rejects you rejects me. And he who rejects me rejects the one who sent me. And the chain of command, of course, as authority does, is traced from the top down. Only Jesus, you know, he traces it backwards now. That ultimately this is a rejection of God. And 58, as Barclay has observed, the whole story is a vivid example of what happens to those who will not face the truth. Those who face the truth may have the humiliation of saying that they were wrong. Well, that's bad. I mean, we've all had to admit we were wrong. We've all had humiliations. We've all had failures. We've all done things we regret. And nobody enjoys all that. But what's the alternative? But those who will not face the truth have nothing but the prospect of deeper and deeper involvement in a situation which renders them increasingly helpless and ineffective. And so, while it may be hard to face the truth, you may not want to see certain things about yourself. And it isn't always pretty. Unfortunately, the mirror of the Word of God reflects what we are, and it isn't always nice to look at. We're well aware of our sin natures. Paul was keenly aware of this in Romans 7. Wretched man that I am. That doesn't sound like to me somebody who's happy. That sounds like a guy that's fighting his sin nature, and the struggle is just miserable because it never goes away. And so we've all ended up with egg on our face. But you know, it's much better to have that, admit you're wrong, deal with it, and move on than it is to live in Never Never Land. Peter Pan, you're going to grow up. Oh, wait a minute. No, if I live in Never Land, I don't have to grow up. Well, yeah, it's time. You got to grow up. We all have to. So again, while it may not be fun, necessarily, when you get caught or you get rebuked or you end up with egg on your face, be aware that that's good. That means, number one, God's keeping you on a pretty short leash. That's good. That means God is dealing with you. That's good. If your conscience bothers you, that's good. You say, well, I don't like my conscience beating me up. Yeah, but what's the alternative? No searing it? We don't want to do that. And that's exactly what these people are doing here. They continue to sear their consciences, reject what they're told, and this is where we're going to end up. Okay, well, we're going to stop there today. It's time to observe, as we do every quarter, the Lord's table, so we will let you get in place for that.